Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name's John Bleasdale. I am a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to the novelist Anthony Mara. Anthony has written three novels, A Constellation of Vital Phenomena, The Tsar of Love and Techno, and his latest book, which we're going to be talking about today, is Mercury Pictures Presents. This novel follows the travails of a fictional studio in the 1940s America, and a fictional Hollywood studio, I guess is the best way of saying it, and the various workers, owners, or studio heads who are dealing with the running of the studio, but also America's imminent entry into the Second World War, the rise of fascism, the immigrant experience, racism. Lots of different topics are addressed by the novel, but it's also a very funny comic novel, as you will hear me express during our conversation. But it's a really good book. You don't need to have read it to listen to the podcast, because we try to keep it spoiler free, but I've got a feeling if you listen to the conversation, you'll want to read the book soon afterwards, so buyer beware in that sense. If you enjoy the podcast, please remember to subscribe and to like and to tweet about it, and to generally, if you could share the word, I would really appreciate it. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation.
So my first two books are set in the former Soviet Union. And after writing two books in that world, both of which deal in different ways with the intersection of art and politics and the creation of propaganda in the former in the USSR and contemporary Russia, after writing two books set in that world, I was ready to come in from the cold. And I figured where better to warm up than Southern California. I used to live in LA. My wife is from there. And I've always been fascinated with this period in LA's history when you saw this incredible cultural transfusion of emigres fleeing Europe and landing in LA. Frank Lloyd Wright once said that if you tip the world on its side, all of the loose pieces end up in Los Angeles. And I think that was probably never more true than in the 1930s and 40s, when thousands of refugees fleeing fascism landed in LA. And what really fascinated me about that period was the ways in which this community was responsible for many of the movies of the 1940s that are best remembered these days, and how they became an integral part of the American propaganda apparatus during the war, even though as citizens of Axis-aligned countries, they were often denied the very rights and freedoms that their movies championed. And that artistic and moral and political set of contradictions just really seemed like a ripe area to set a novel within. I think that often depictions of filmmaking and depictions of Hollywood, particularly in the Golden Age, really lean into the decadence and the excess, and essentially treat Hollywood as a fundamentally unserious place. In the research I did, in the reading, in the work of a number of guests who have appeared on this very podcast, it seemed to me that view of both the period and the industry was flawed somewhat, and I was interested in maybe taking a somewhat different approach on that period.
Really interesting that you say that, because I think that's what I got. There was a real sense of admiration for some of these people and the mavericks, and not uncritical, but focused. And then you see something like Babylon, which I haven't seen yet. I hasten to add, but even from the title and the reference obviously is to Kenneth Anger's Hollywood Babylon, there's this sense of like that the sleazy Hollywood is the Hollywood that sort of lives most vibrantly in our imaginations.
Yeah, I think that's so true. I think it's not without a degree of merit, but I think, like all, as has been said, the problem with cliches isn't necessarily that it's that cliches are completely false, but that they simply narrow the field of experience to one story. I think I was interested in looking at some of these other stories that appear during this period. And one of the things that I find so fascinating is how the movies that live on in the cultural imagination the most from that period, I think, are the ones that were fundamentally interested in politics in some way. I mean, the movie that I think probably has endured the most is obviously Casablanca, and that's a movie that was made by and about refugees, and it came not only to really define and express the experience of many of the participants in the making of that movie, who had fled Europe, but also came to really define how America came to see itself in that period. And those seem to be some of the films and the stories that maybe undercut this image of Hollywood as this preposterous place filled with frivolous people.
Casablanca I rewatched quite recently, and I thought it's so amazing not only how much that film is, as you say, and Noah Eisenberg's book about it is a really, really good read if our listeners haven't already
Oh, fantastic. I absolutely love that book.
Yeah, superb. You know, all the stories behind even small roles, people who have come from Germany, it's an anti-Nazi movie, which is so anti-Nazi, even the Nazis are played by anti-Nazis.
Yeah, I think that's a great example, though, of some of the paradoxes that a number of these figures faced, where you have German Jewish actors who can only find work in Hollywood portraying the very villains they thought they had escaped.
Which, of course, you feature in your novel as well, in terms of the character of Ed, who is a Chinese actor, Chinese American, who can only get roles as sort of villainous Japanese post Pearl Harbor, or even, I mean, you know, there are other villainous characters that he plays pre Pearl Harbor as well.
It's sort of this rather bizarre set of circumstances in which a number of Asian American actors, Philip Bond, Richard Liu, Chester Gunn, suddenly found themselves in a position where they were in high demand due to the necessity of creating anti-Japanese movies. Eddie, as you mentioned, is this character who has spent his entire career being typecast in roles that fall far below his talents. He's sort of the only major character in the novel who was born in the U.S. And really the only major character who has much genuine talent in the book. But because of the racist typecasting that was so prevalent in Hollywood during that period, both on the set and off, and that continues in many ways through to the present day, he is as much of an outsider and an exile as the emigres that he works with. And following Pearl Harbor, he is hired by the studio Mercury Pictures to play Japanese villains. And one of the things that I found so interesting about, dramatically interesting about this, you know, sort of circumstance that he finds himself in is that the war really puts this character, Eddie, in a position where his livelihood comes in direct conflict with his conscience. And I think that this was sort of an existential position that many figures involved in the propaganda business found themselves in, where they, you know, Eddie really abhors the sort of racist caricatures that he's assigned, but he's also determined to take advantage of this brief moment where he has a bit of bargaining power in an industry that has long marginalized him.
That's what I think makes the novel so fascinating, is how there are these complicated, you know, moments where characters are genuinely challenged by the price of success and then what they can reap back from those compromises, what they can sort of how they can empower themselves, but does that come at the cost of a larger political problem?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the through line or perhaps thematic reoccurrences in the novel is the presence of devil's bargains.
Right.
And it's during this time period, Thomas Mann was writing Dr. Faustus in the Pacific Palisades. His son, Klaus, wrote Mephisto a decade prior, which also is an updated version of the Faustian tale. And I find like devil's bargains in general to be an incredibly powerful dramatic tool, because I think that we all face devil's bargains every day on much smaller scales, that every choice is a compromise to one extent or another. And I think that these moral conflicts are perhaps more interesting than other forms of conflict, because it pits characters not only against outside forces but also against themselves. And so throughout the novel, more or less every character is every major character faces some kind of devil's bargain. And in fact, that is the name of one of the movies that that this studio is producing that gets them in, you know, quite hot water with a number of reactionary forces in the months leading up to Pearl Harbor.
I don't want to obviously spoil the novel too much for people who haven't had an opportunity to read it yet, although I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who've already read it listening to this. But how would you set it up for someone who hasn't read the novel what's your sort of your elevator pitch, so to speak?
the book is set within a studio called Mercury Pictures, which is I sort of envisioned as almost a Poverty Row version of Warner Brothers, a studio whose movies are, you know, a mix of schlock and social message movies that rely on the free publicity of Scandal to generate publicity. And the studio is run by Artie and Ned Feldman, who are loosely based on Jack and Harry Warner. And our sort of focal point for the novel is Artie's right-hand woman, a character named Maria Lagana, who is an associate producer. And she was probably my favorite character to write. I she's this tough, ambitious, irreverence driver. I pictured her as Rosalind Russell's character in His Girl Friday, only a bit more salty and a lot more Italian. And when we first meet her, her boss, Artie, is under investigation by isolationists in the U.S. Congress. The studio is struggling financially, and her personal and professional lives are in a bit of a state. And like many characters in the book, she arrives to Mercury essentially in flight from Europe. She grew up in fascist Italy and fled to Los Angeles with her mother after a childhood transgression led to her father's arrest. And her father is imprisoned in southern Italy. And her experience over the course of her adolescence with writing to him and sort of trying to negotiate the postal censor in Italy that censors their correspondence sort of gives her a talent for writing around censors, which proves beneficial to her career in Hollywood, where, you know, the censorship of the production code is one of the primary governing forces. So even though Maria has sort of reinvented herself as this unflappable producer, she is still haunted by the role that she played in her father's fate, until one day a man from her father's past arrives at the studio among all of these other refugees that have come to Mercury to find work. And with his appearance, the various fictions she has spun to survive begin to unravel.
It's funny how I love that idea of Rosalind Russell. Who did you picture as Artie then? Because I mean, that
definitely not Cary Grant.
Right. Yeah, no, that would have worked. Well, first of all, Cary Grant's got a full head of hair.
It's true. Yeah. So one of the real joys of writing a novel set in this world is that you can sort of move between different styles and tropes. So for a lot of the front office, you know, business was very much pitched in a screwball comedy sort of mode. There are other chapters that sort of send up, you know, some of the film noir traditions. There are, you know, obviously war film becomes a fact later in the book, and sort of being able to shift between, you know, some of the most popular genres of the period became one of the underlying interests and motives for writing it.
But you're not going to give me a name, you know.
I'm not.
Also, when you the very title sort of the studio Mercury Pictures makes me think immediately of Orson Welles as a possible thing, and I was kind of thinking, yeah, Warner's. But then Jack Warner is actually in the novel, so there's a bit where it can't be Warner's because there's Warner's,
right?
A little bit RKO because of the fact that it's got the Mercury and the Orson Welles connection. But then I was also thinking there's a little bit of sort of ahistorically, there's a little bit of sort of a Roger Corman kind of structure to this sort of a studio that's definitely hanging on by its fingernails financially.
I sort of pictured Mercury as being at the same sort of the same level of a republic or a monogram, sort of a studio of that level of you know, financial security and artistic achievement. Yeah, there's an Orson Welles reference sort of midway through the book when the attack on Pearl Harbor was announced in LA, a number of people assumed that it was Orson Welles, you know, sort of causing a panic again, as he did with his War of the Worlds broadcast. And one of the reasons that I wanted to sort of tip my hat to Orson Welles and Mercury in the title and in the name of the studio is the fact that the War of the Worlds broadcast created this, you know, this hysteria in America in a similar way as some of the films that Mercury Pictures, this fictitious studio, creates a degree of panic following Pearl Harbor and the release of a number of these propaganda movies.
Yeah, I mean, you've got this great structure as well of having sort of a situation and then quite lengthy sort of flashbacks to provide context for some of these characters, particularly Maria at the very beginning, but then you have other characters, Italian characters, who go back to fill in their thing. But it's also interesting in terms of the sort of history and the moment, the situation that they find themselves in the moment, that Europe is kind of rehearsing the Second World War before the Second World War starts, and fascism is there long before before Nazism is there, and so you've got this situation where you, the characters, can see sort of, and some of them have experienced it before it comes to America, so to speak. I was thinking particularly in the case of Maria's father, that idea of the particular Mussolini's sort of like invention of sort of exiling people within the country so that they would be sent to a village. I live in Italy, and I know that in Italy, your identity is very much based on your local region where you're from. So that if you get sent to the south and you're from the north or vice versa, then you're very much, it's like a foreign country. And that sort of situation is similar to how a lot of the characters find themselves in. There's no prison around them, but there is a kind of psychological prison, if you like.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the sort of connection between how internal exiles in Italy experienced exile and how these refugees in America experienced exile during the war was actually sort of the point when the book really came together for me. So right. So when I began thinking about this project, it was originally I was debating between writing a novel set exclusively in LA during this period and one set in Southern Italy during you know this similar period, and I sort of envisioned them as two separate novels, and for months I was bouncing back and forth between the two of them. I'm not particularly known for decisiveness. I have trouble committing to an appetizer, let alone a multi-year book project. And things finally came together for me when my wife and I took a trip to Lipari, which is the largest of the Aeolian Islands off the coast of Sicily. It's also happens to be where my great-grandmother's family emigrated from. And it's this stunning island. It's, you know, one of this chain of volcanic islands with these, you know, sweeping views and spectacular beaches. And, you know, it looks like just a, you know, a postcard from paradise. And on one of our last days there, we noticed this little plaque that was high up on the wall of the citadel. And the plaque commemorated the various anti-fascists and artists and intellectuals who had been exiled to Lipari by Mussolini. And in fact, Lipari was the largest internment colony in Italy under Mussolini. And I had never heard of this particular chapter in the island's history. And it was hard to imagine that this island paradise that I could, you know, trace my own roots to had once been Mussolini's Alcatraz. And it occurred to me as I was, you know, sort of standing there that German and Austrian exiles sometimes referred to Los Angeles as sunny Siberia. And it seemed that this same term could be easily applied to Lipari as well. And so it seemed that to me that Los Angeles and that the Los Angeles novel and the Italy novel weren't two separate books, but were rather halves of the same book. And that Mercury Pictures Presents would be the story of these two sunny Siberias and this one family divided between them.
That's fascinating. That's so interesting that we you know, you look at these places and you sometimes think, as you say, they're sunny, they're wonderful from a certain point of view. But if you're forced to be there, it doesn't matter where it is and what you're doing. It's that idea of compulsion and the lack of freedom which makes it.
Yeah, and sort of that, as you said, that like so much of the sense of confinement and imprisonment was psychological. That these were places, you know, both in Italy and in the areas where internal exiles were sent. There wouldn't be barbed wire. There wouldn't be, you know, big walls. It was often simply a particular area that they were allowed to live in, and they weren't allowed to go past these sort of invisible markers outside of whether it was the town limits or, you know, a river or what have you. And in Los Angeles, during the war, citizens of Axis countries were classified as enemy aliens, even if they fled to the U.S. as refugees. And they were prohibited from traveling more than 5 miles from their house. If they lived on the coastline, they were forced to move inland. They had to, you know, surrender cameras, radios, flashlights, anything that could potentially be used to spy or commit acts of sabotage. And the ways in which the U.S. began to, you know, in some subtle ways resemble and put into practice elements from the very fascist countries that they were at war with felt to me like an aspect of the history of World War II on the American home front that, you know, is often downplayed in our history. I think that Americans tend to be very proud of our role in the Second World War with, you know, with some justification. I think it's often because, you know, we've been involved in so many disastrous foreign wars in the year since, and you know, at least we can look back on this one and say, well, you know, we were on the side of the angels. But I think that sort of greatest generation mythology often maybe flattens some of the complexities and the ways in which we were complicit in the very evils that we purportedly fighting against.
Yeah, absolutely. Specifically in the treatment of the Japanese in terms mm-hmm. of and also sort of, yeah, you're fighting some an ideology which has at its core a racism, and then you use racism for your own propaganda ends in terms of demonizing, which I think was always more true in the Pacific theater and the Japanese enemy than it was in the against the Germans. You know, you couldn't really, Anglo-Europeans couldn't really turn to the Germans and use racist epithets against them.
Yeah, I think that is entirely true, and it's also, you know, it's visible in the very movies of the time. Did you ever read Projections of War by Thomas Doherty?
No, I haven't. No,
it's a brilliant, brilliant book. All of his books are fantastic. But in Projections of War, he goes through and looks at how Germans, Italians, and Japanese were portrayed as villains, and how you know, so often and it's their images that endure to this day. The portrayal of Nazis as these, you know, cool, callous, sort of sociopathic villains. Who are very calculating and devious, but in a way highly rational. Whereas, you know, Italians were usually portrayed as, if they were portrayed as at all, as sort of buffoons, like they were the comic relief.
Who would often swap sides at some point in the film. Would often
exactly.
maybe be won over to the good side. Maybe be sort of traitorous and you know, but definitely untrustworthy.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, Japanese, the Japanese characters in these movies often weren't even presented as characters. They were, I think it was Thomas Doherty's book. Maybe it was, it might've been Hollywood Goes to War. It might've been in Hollywood Goes to War by Clayton Copps, where the author looks at how Native Americans were portrayed in Westerns and how Japanese soldiers were portrayed in World War II films, and how both the ways in which they were othered, the ways in which they were presented as less than human, as being denied even the humanity of a point of view in the actual shot by shot.
That's fascinating, because I was watching Thin Red Line recently, and I think that film is very interesting in how it doesn't show the Japanese, almost like it's a Vietnam War movie in which the Viet Cong are represented by the jungle rather than by actual soldiers. You see the sort of consequences of their, you first come across corpses that have been desecrated, and then you see, and then they're just sort of points of fire, and then they're a gun barrel. And then when they actually get to the Japanese, they're obviously these emaciated, malarial, suffering, human beings, wretches, really. But then there's this remarkable shot of a Japanese face that's basically been pounded into the earth, and you get the voiceover of this Japanese soldier saying, "Are you noble? Do you think I wasn't loved? Do you think I wasn't admired? Do you think this made me immune to what the world did to me?" And it's just, I'm paraphrasing, but it's just such a fascinating and unusual way of showing the enemy of the war film through a series of stages, which actually by the end of it is kind of quite empathetic.
That's fascinating. Yeah. And I mean, that seems like something that, you certainly wouldn't have seen in the films of the 40s.
What's the Bogart movie as well, isn't there? There's a Bogart movie with Sidney Greenstreet. Is it like Northwest Passage or something, which is very virulently anti-Japanese?
Yeah. I mean, so many of them. Like, right. The most, the most heinous, I think, was probably Little Tokyo, USA, in part because the filmmakers actually went to Little Tokyo in Los Angeles and filmed the forced relocation of Japanese Americans and included it in the film as the film describes it, sort of like the just result for sabotage. And so not only does the film, does this film essentially excuse, but really celebrate the decision to intern Japanese Americans, but it also used those very real human beings as extras in this, in this grotesque movie in a way that, that I think is beyond ugly, and is one of those cases where you look at that movie and it's feels like a Nazi propaganda movie in terms of its demonization and the way that it blends this sort of paranoid espionage plot with the very real ramifications of that kind of racialized hysteria that was gripping the U.S. at the time. I think that one of the things about the movies of this period and that in the novel I just found myself fascinated with is how a culture defines its enemies says so much more about that culture than it does about the supposed monsters. And I think that obviously America has an incredibly troubled history with race, and so often we have historically defined villains along racial lines, and that was certainly the case in so many of these movies of the 1940s.
And so there's a sort of sense of projection as well with the, I always think that Hollywood very much goes on the man bites dog sort of. I mean, I think it's something not necessarily inherent in Hollywood as such, but inherent in all drama, all fiction, all novels, is that sort of goes against the idea of art as being this sort of purveyor of truth. Is, you know, if you read books, there's much more. If you read novels thinking you're going to get a view of what reality is like, it's going to be skewed very much in favor of drama and murder and violence and betrayal and all these sort of things, rather than, you know, the rather humdrum reality of what life's actually like. I was thinking recently of an example of that being the sort of hoopla over the new film Tar, which seems to be, let's do a sort of Me Too story, but with the male figure changed into a female figure, so that it's about bullying and it's about inappropriate use of power. But we'll swap out the man for a woman because, you know, that's man bites dog. That's, you know, dog bites man isn't interesting in the same way. So,
yeah, I mean, I think my wife is an art historian specializing in photography. And when my previous book, The Tsar of Love and Techno, came out, while I was working on it, she showed me a number of these folios of photographs from the Civil War. Combat photographers were moving around corpses, were sort of staging scenes. And the idea that, you know, 10 years after the advent of photography, it was already being used to manipulate reality and sort of record these images that purported to be real, that were nonetheless staged, is something that I've always been sort of fascinated with. This idea that at the, you know, this tension at the heart of filmmaking, that that it's a medium that can be both subjective art and objective evidence. You know, it can be used to create fantasy and record reality. And this is, I think, an unresolvable conflict at the heart of the medium. I think many of these characters struggle with, and that I think filmmakers in general have to contend with.
Yeah. I guess novels don't have that same direct ability to even purport to transparency. You know, you can't, mm-hmm. It's obviously a narrative. It's obviously, these are stories being told. And with your novel, there's a sense of people having backstories, for instance, that are viewed in different ways. You know, different characters experience roughly the same thing, but they have totally different views of how that event actually happened, or why it happened, or what the consequences are. One thing I wanted to ask actually was the way we're talking about it now, it sounds very, very serious. We're talking about, you know, major events, and we're giving them the necessary respect they deserve, absolutely. But your book's so funny, and it's without...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In any way, rendering what it's not silly. It's not funny in a silly way. It's not unserious, but it is very, very funny. And I just wanted to make sure we convey to our listeners that this is a really fun read, despite or even because of the fact that what it's talking about is a serious moment in history.
Yeah. Well. Thank you. I'm relieved to hear that. I find myself just really impatient with humorless novels and humorless movies. I think that, you know, to me, life feels essentially to be an absurd enterprise. And I think that absurdity is most eloquently expressed through humor. I think that, you know, it's humor is sort of how we try to comprehend the incomprehensible. So I think that that no matter how serious the subject of a particular work is, if there's not humor in it, it feels kind of false to me. I come from a people who make jokes at all of the wrong moments. I think that even when we're in the midst of tragedy, there is a natural tendency to try to find a bit of comedy in it. And I think that, you know, when I think about like some of the movies that have meant the most to me and that have hit me the hardest, particularly from this period, the movie more than any other one would have to be To Be or Not to Be by Ernst Lubitsch. And you know, that's a movie that is profoundly, profoundly funny, and yet it is set in the most serious and desperate of times. You know, that's a movie that is set in occupied Poland. It came out in 1942, 3 months after Pearl Harbor. It feels, watching it today, you know, it's this, for anyone who hasn't seen it, I strongly recommend you do. It stars Jack Benny and Carol Lombard. It was Carol Lombard's last film prior to her death, and it's this satire of this Polish theater company essentially trying to use the various tricks of their trade to escape Poland. It is, you know, it's laugh out loud funny. Like there are moments of high farce, and yet Lubitsch, I feel like throughout the movie, he wields comedy like a scalpel. And I feel like watching it, you come to sense that that a joke can be a deadly serious thing. And he is relentless with using satire to expose the horrors of life under Nazi rule. And the idea that a movie can be both, you know, so silly and so somber at the same time is something that has certainly influenced my own work to a great degree. And I think that those are the experiences that I most often try to seek out, whether in a novel or on the screen.
It's interesting that Lubitsch's film was being made prior to Pearl Harbor, and you know, you did have these. I was talking to Chris last for the last episode of last episode but one, with his book Hollywood Hates Hitler. You had these films like Confessions of a Nazi Spy and The Great Dictator coming out prior to Pearl Harbor, and this is also where you take the beginning of your book is where you have Mercury and Artie having to go to Washington and sort of defend themselves, because, and this is another thing that, you know, you referred to the Great Generation and the Good War, another detail which is sometimes forgotten or glossed over, is that prior to Pearl Harbor, there was a fairly bullish large section of the population and of the political class that wanted to stay well out of the war and actually had some admiration for the German Nazi Party and for the sort of Axis, what then became the Axis powers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Charles Lindbergh, was the spokesman for the America First Committee, and he was, you know, now we think of him as, you know, as this simply as, you know, a celebrated aviator, but he was perhaps the biggest celebrity, the most influential, you know, cultural figure of that moment, and he was 100% in favor of of playing nice with Germany and essentially letting England deal with the problems in their backyard on their own and staying well out of it. I think that there is a tendency to imagine that World War II began in December 1941, and obviously that wasn't the case. And for the years prior, we did isolationism was far more popular a policy stance than interventionism in the U.S. And one of the things that I found so interesting, and you referenced Chris and his book Hollywood Hates Hitler, is absolutely brilliant. I recommend that anyone who hasn't read it pick it up. I also recently got my hands on his new biography of the Warner Brothers, which is fantastic as well. But But he, in that book, he describes the investigation into so-called war propaganda by a group of isolationist senators who wanted to essentially force Hollywood's hand in the few cases in which anti-Nazi movies were being produced. And yeah, I think that that in how we look at America, so. I think that this is a historical novel, and I think that one of the pitfalls of historical fiction in general is that there's often a degree of nostalgia to the project. And one of the guiding principles that I sort of set out for myself when I was working on this is to try to avoid nostalgia at all costs and look at how history was fictionalized within these moments themselves. And so looking at 1939, 1940, 1941, at the American, the forces in America that were most belligerently against any sort of intervention felt like a worthwhile project.
They provide their own sort of comic seriousness as well, in the sense that what they're trying to do is very serious and very dangerous, and of course has echoes. Forewarnings, I guess, of HUAC in the 50s and on, of where the lessons have sort of to some degree have been learned, and Hollywood kind of collapses in a way that it doesn't in the 1941 version.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of fascinating how, given it's given how successful Hollywood was in fighting, in sort of acquitting themselves during, the late 30s and 40s and early 40s in these various, these various show trials. It's understandable why, in the late 40s, they went into the HUAC investigations really feeling like they had this in hand, and to see how sort of quickly they collapsed in those cases is quite dismaying, and you can see how perhaps in retrospect their successes in the 1941 Senate investigations led them to enter the HUAC trials with perhaps a sense of overconfidence and maybe a degree of having underestimated how American culture and society had changed in the intervening years.
Another of the sort of crossovers as well, I'm sure these are sort of intentional nods. You already mentioned the Orson Welles nod to the Martian radio story, but 1941, the film that Steven Spielberg makes, which is kind of a weirdly disastrous film in some ways, and a disaster film in another, because it's all about massive destruction. That at the moment that actually inspired that film, which is a sort of fear of the Japanese were attacking Los Angeles and various anti-aircraft guns fire off, and you get a little bit of a mass panic there as well. You refer to that and depict that scene as well. Did you have a little bit of Spielberg in your head while you were doing that?
There's always a little Spielberg in my head. But yeah, I mean, the Battle of Los Angeles is this sort of iconic moment, I think, in LA history, in terms of the panic it wrought, the fear and hysteria that came out of that, but also how in some ways the Battle of Los Angeles feels like something from a movie, where a battle against shadows. There was nothing there. It was a lot of light, a lot of special effects, and the only casualties, I believe, were people who got in traffic accidents during.
Yeah, the evacuation was more costly than the thing they were evacuating to avoid. It sort of also goes to show how acts of the imagination can be great. We can have movies, we can have novels, we can have. But also acts of the imagination can be, from political ideologies to to mass hysteria can cause untold damage.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of my pet peeves are in literature are novels that sort of uncritically fetishize storytelling as this unadulterated good, that that the very act of telling a story is somehow virtuous in and of itself. And I think that, you know, that there are there's a similar instinct in many films that valorize filmmaking as
Another love letter to cinema. God damn it. We've had five this year. Five. And it's only January the 2nd.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that that there's something that I find troubling in the idea that that the medium itself is seen as morally as morally righteous, when in fact, you know, a novel, a story, a movie, like any other instrument of persuasion, can be used for very destructive ends. And I think that, you know, it's something that I think in the past, you know, seven years or so, certainly in America, we've been thinking of, or hopefully we've been considering more and more, just in terms of the fictions that have been spun by, you know, so many of our political leaders in ways that are, you know, very damaging. And I think that as as a novelist, I'm always aware that the very thing that I'm doing, essentially creating fabrications, even if they're fabrications built, you know, on research and built on sources and anchored in reality, they're still fictions. How the very tools of my trade can be used by political actors to really destructive ends. And I think that we would be wise as, you know, as artists in general to be more wary of our mediums.
Yeah, absolutely. The co-opting of sort of the ability to tell. It's similarly with humor. I mean, the rise of the alt-right on the internet has been absolutely, the rocket fuel that they've used as this sort of only kidding, you know, just kidding irony, you know, wink, wink, don't be so serious. Oh, ha ha, got you, you know. And trolling, the entire activity of trolling is based on a sort of tension between the serious and the, you know, what do you really mean? Are you really, what are you really saying? You know, I remember 10 years ago, postmodernism being all about that sort of play, you know. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. when someone turns up to the playground with bad intentions, we no longer have anywhere to stand which is properly secure, I think. Wow, that was very deep.
You should have a podcast.
Yeah, I should do, shouldn't I? Like every other white man in his 50s. Absolutely. I love going back and rethinking about Hollywood from this period. And I really appreciated the opportunity to do so with your novel. I'd love to know as well, though, sort of, do you have any books that you would recommend our readers to go to? I'm going to drop this question on you, because usually I ask for a recommended book, but I'm also interested in were there any like novels about Hollywood that you particularly, or about filmmaking in general, that you particularly would like to underline and point out?
Yeah, it's a great question. So maybe first I'll start with some nonfiction. So my absolute favorite book on 1940s Hollywood is City of Nets by Otto Friedrich, which is just a remarkable book. He wrote it intentionally avoiding all in-person interviews. He came to sort of see that most of the players in Hollywood would, you know, relentlessly untruthful about their own histories, and so he relied only on other books, and I believe he sort of condensed 500 sources, 500 books into City of Nets, and he has just this genius for managing to pick out the most interesting little tidbits. And as a novelist, I feel like I'm always looking for, you know, I'm much less interested in big sweeping airplane view histories, and I'm much more interested in sort of like the little texture, the textures and the small particulars and specifics that gradually grow into characters. And so, for instance, one of the little details that I actually begin the acknowledgments of my own book with comes from City of Nets. It's this anecdote about Irving Thalberg, who was making a movie and he wanted to have this romantic Parisian seascape scene. And those of us who have seen a map or have been to France will realize that Paris is nowhere near the ocean. And this fact was underlined and pointed out to Thalberg by his various assistants, who used maps and atlases to demonstrate this. And Thalberg was not deterred. His response was that he refused to cater to the handful of people who knew Paris. City of Nets is just filled with those wonderful little anecdotes. I would also say another book that I really loved and that I relied on a lot was Hollywood the Dream Factory by the wonderfully named Hortense Powdermaker.
That's a novelist invention. That person does not exist.
I didn't believe so either, but she has a Wikipedia page, so it must be, she must be real. But she was an anthropologist who I believe did field work in Papua New Guinea and came back to the US and essentially treated Hollywood as she would a group of any other sort of closed society that she had been studying in Papua New Guinea, and she looks at the various taboos, the rituals, the power structures, the dreams and desires and all of this that governed Hollywood in the 40s. And it's this really fascinating look at how Hollywood sort of organized itself in terms of power and taboos. And she wasn't a journalist, she was an anthropologist, she had access to a number of people who perhaps wouldn't have been as willing to speak with an on the record journalist. So that book is absolutely wonderful. And maybe the final fiction book that I will highlight is Hollywood. God, these books are terribly titled. They're all like Hollywood colon this. So this one is Hollywood, the Movie Colony, the Movie Makers, and it's by Leo Rostin. And he was a sociologist, I believe, who came to Hollywood in the early 40s with a team of statisticians. And essentially, it's an academic book that is wildly, wildly engaging. And he picks up, just so many wonderful little snippets, many of which I incorporated into this novel. Even his footnotes are brilliant. He in one footnote he has he describes this high school student who essentially rented out this network of clappers to attend premieres.
Oh, yes. I remember that from your novel. Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's a brilliant story.
So that was in one of his footnotes. This is a book that was so good. I ended up, I underlined it the first time I read it, and I underlined so much that I had to go back and re-underline in a different color just to, sort of to cut things down a bit. But unfortunately, it's out of print. But if you can get a find a copy at a library or get a secondhand copy, I would highly recommend it. In terms of fiction, you know, certainly The Day of the Locusts by Nathaniel West was a big influence. I think that he is someone who you know, obviously had worked in sort of the down market end of the Hollywood, you know, the Hollywood movie making business. And he I think explores that with great sensitivity and beauty in Day of the Locusts. So of the various Hollywood novels, I think that would be the one from that period that I felt most influenced by.
I only know that via the film. I only know that via and the film kind of really depresses me. Go back to the original, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book. It's definitely you know, it's definitely not a I wouldn't call it uplifting, but it's one that I feel like, you know, at the time he was working, I believe he was writing B pictures at RKO. He wrote in this period Stranger on the Third Floor, which I believe has been, you know, cited as sort of one of the first kind of noir films to emerge. I think that was in
Peter Lorre film, I think, if I remember right.
Exactly. Yeah. Who gets top billing but only appears in, you know, in the last 5 minutes of the film. But yeah, he's someone who I you know, he, I don't think he really broke in to the screenwriting world the way that he hoped he would, but that book is fantastic.
Right. I've definitely got it on my list. It's one of those little holes in my, you know, reading background that I need to fill as soon as possible. In fact, I'm buying a lot of those Library of America hardbacks, and I think there's enough Nathaniel West. And he's that justifies the outlay of $30, I reckon.
Between that and Miss Lonely Hearts, you're set. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's research. It's research I'm doing. It's not for my own pleasure. It's not for my own. I'm sacrificing myself to the world of film and books and podcasts. So.
Exactly.
Another recommendation I just wanted to add on top, not of a book but of a film. Anybody interested in The Internal Exile? Situation. I'm sure this is a film you're probably familiar with. I'm not sure if it was a film or originally sort of like a mini series, a three part. Was Rossi's Christ Stopped at Eberly, starring Gianmaria Volonté, which is a really good sort of portrayal of an intellectual who finds himself in a situation similar to one we were talking about earlier, where he's in internal exile in Italy, and anything with Gianmaria Volonté is worth watching because for my money, he's the best Italian actor.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. I actually got to see it in the theater. It never received an American theatrical release, I believe. It was released in theaters maybe 4 years ago.
Right.
Yeah, I saw it. I was living in Oakland, California at the time, and the theater was completely sold out. There were a couple of people were scalping tickets outside. It was kind of wild to see that much interest in a movie from the 70s, I believe. And I would also encourage people to read the book it's based on as well by Carlo Levi.
Yeah.
It's an absolutely brilliant book, and one that I think it's a very faithful adaptation. But also, so much of the book is simply about you know, Levy's sort of quiet musings on the various towns that he finds himself in, and he has this one. God, I don't believe it made it into the movie, but he has this one scene describing this sort of public toilet facility in one of the towns that he found himself in, and it's this sort of like gorgeous, you know, marble thing, and it's in this town where there's no running water, where there's no, you know, electricity. And it turns out that the mayor's brother-in-law is a toilet purveyor up north, and a bunch of ducklings have sort of come to live in one of the toilet bowls, and another one is used for laundry. And it's just this brilliant image. He describes this toilet as being an asteroid that had landed in the south from the north. And yeah, just really quite beautiful.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great recommendation. And I was also this is just a couple of things, because I didn't want to interrupt you when you were talking earlier, but a couple of things that it reminded me of when we were talking. One was when you mentioned Thomas Mann and his son, how maybe I got this from Otto Friedrich's City of Nets, actually, that his son used to write down subjects on his cuffs, so that when he had dinner with his father, Thomas Mann, he could talk to him, because otherwise he was sort of paralyzed with nervousness talking to his father. So he was up to the intellectual level of his father, and I'd always thought that was hilarious, in an incredibly sad way, but still, still hilarious. So, Dad, what do you think of the decimalization of
very casual?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, moving on. Egon Schell. And the other thing that when we were talking right at the very beginning, and this is probably a good way of folding it up, about how we look to Hollywood and we see sort of Fatty Arbuckle and the sort of the sleazy, the scandalous, and the, you know, the Babylonian nature of it. I was researching a novel once, and I was lucky enough to get to know Frank Cottrell Boyce, who for many years wrote screenplays for Danny Boyle. And I sent him a version of the novel to because it was based on an independent film being made in Britain, and I wanted the sort of to see if it was realistic. And he's one of my main characters was this sort of like alcoholic director, and he said the whole premise of the novel is problematic because the guy wouldn't get the money, and there would be someone on top of him at all times, and he couldn't just wander off for the night and, you know, and go drinking and go partying or whatever. There would be someone from the studio sort of sitting on him, and he'd have an early night, and he would, you know, and he was talking about his relationship with Danny Boyle, and said, you know, how Danny would, you know, he would work very, very hard, be up first person on the set, last person to go home, then he'd watch dailies, then he'd have 5 hours sleep, and then he'd start again. And this idea that there's this sort of like, whoa, here we go, just is very rare, because it ultimately is an industry. And if you're not making the product, yeah, I mean, I think we've seen some situations in which that people have gone off the rails a bit. Bohemian Rhapsody most recently, perhaps, in terms of that sort of lifestyle not being conducive to creating an actual film, and how Hollywood sort of will, I wonder if in the case of Bohemian Rhapsody, Bryan Singer will recover from that. Not in terms of whatever perceived scandals, of which I believe there are some, but more because, you know, you didn't do the job, you didn't finish the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's there are obviously similar images, sort of these romantic images that we have of novelists as well, in terms of being, you know, alcoholics who drag themselves to the typewriter and, you know, produce genius. And in my own experience as a writer, in terms of the writers that I know, you know, the people who are up late doing drugs and partying aren't up early, you know, writing. And I think that that all you know, all artistic creation is difficult. And I think that, you know, the people whose work we must admire, the the people who are most productive, the people whose movies and whose novels, you know, endure, I think are more often than not those that take their craft seriously. And I think that, you know, whether you're a director or a novelist or a photographer, if your work isn't you know at the center of your life, it's difficult to find the wherewithal to you know to continue producing.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. I mean, we love the romantic idea of the guy who just sits down at the piano and writes, you know, Rhapsody in Blue, but I know it's been a little bit challenged, the old 10,000 hours idea from Malcolm Gladwell, popularized in one of his essays. I know it's not science, let's say, but but I think as an idea, you know, you've got to put in the work, other stuff around that. I mean, I don't know. There are the exceptional. I mean, I think of someone like Rainer Werner Fassbinder and his, you know. But I mean, he had a huge appetite for drugs and drink, and but also he must have had a huge appetite for work, because my God, what did he produce? He produced like 2 or 3 films a year. He produced a massive 30-hour-long television program that was that is considered probably his masterpiece, with Berlin Allen Alexanderplatz. But maybe he's the exception that proves the rule, because crikey, you know, some of his films are amazing.
Yeah, no, I think there's probably always there are probably always outliers, but you know, I had a teacher who used to say that they would only write when they were inspired, but they made sure that they were inspired at 9 a.m. Monday through Friday. and I always felt like that for me at least has been a good way to think of artistic inspiration and all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. It's about sitting down. If you can master sitting down, then the rest of it's relatively easy. You know? Brilliant. Oh, thank you so much, Anthony, for coming on the podcast and talking about your novel. It was an absolute pleasure to read. And I highly recommend it. That could be my recommended book of the week.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. This has been such a treat.
So that was my conversation with Anthony. I hope you enjoyed it. I had a great time talking to him. I loved his novel and I highly recommend it. Mercury Pictures Presents is the title. So there you go. You can get that from all good booksellers everywhere. All that's left... Oh, his recommended books were Otto Friedrich's City of Nets, which has been recommended before. I think it might even have been recommended in the first ever episode of Writers on Film. But it's such a brilliant book. It deserves multiple recommendations. So if you haven't had an opportunity to read it, that would be one to go for. I would love to have Otto Friedrich on the podcast, but unfortunately he died several years ago. All that's left for me to do is to thank Elliot Atkins from the music, Ali Harwood for the art, and to thank you, dear listeners. It's a new year. 2023 has just begun. What a great episode to begin with. And hopefully we're going to go on and continue with Writers on Film for as long as the guests want to talk to me and for as long as you wish to hear. Thank you very much for supporting us through last year, and looking forward to a bunch of new guests and a bunch of great experiences and episodes and conversations. Take care.
It's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.